from GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Doctors take an oath to do no harm, but in states with the death penalty, that can become a difficult issue.
As long as they can continue to perform executions in Georgia, then I think those individuals on death row deserve to have a physician present at the time of their death.
Dr. Carlo Musso has executed Georgia Instrument inmates since 2003, and he's at the center of a new documentary playing at the Atlanta Film Festival tomorrow. A conversation with the film's director is ahead. First, though, Friday, our break room crew was not happy that a lingerie store in Kennesaw was asked to remove ads with plus-sized and disabled models.
I am far more offended by the sexualization of teenagers on the Forever 21 website than real women wearing something that real women wear.
Here are your first thoughts. Sam Burnham tweeted, "Why are Victoria's Secret ads in good taste, but reality is in poor taste?" And Catherine Cummings also tweeted, "The brainwashing of girls starts at birth. Pink, bows, frills, princess dresses, and in school they're not encouraged in math and science." We always love to get your thoughts, so call us at 404-500-9457. You can leave us a message. We're on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Last month, Augusta lost two grocery stores downtown, a Whole Foods and a Kroger. Both say they did not have enough customers to stay open. But that Kroger was the only full-service store within a two-mile radius of downtown Augusta, so it is now much harder to find affordable, healthy food in urban parts of the city. With me to talk about this is Christy Cunningham, Executive Director of the Downtown Cooperative Church Ministries, and she helps operate a food pantry there in Augusta. Hi, Christy.
Good morning. How are you?
Christy, I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. How many people do you feed on a daily basis?
On any given day, about 75 clients.
75?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With us on the phone is Garth Graham. He's a cardiologist and president of the Aetna Foundation. Hi, Garth.
Good morning. How are you?
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Garth, food desert is a particularly urban problem. Do we know why it is difficult to keep full-service groceries in urban areas?
Yeah, so that's actually the definition of a food desert is having a lack of access to a healthy food source within 1 mile. So it's particularly urban, but we also see that in a number of other semi-urban populations as well. And really a part of the problem right now is driven by economics. And certainly we've seen where a number of outlets in terms of supermarkets and grocery chains have closed down in urban areas, particularly because of low sales. So that's one particular driving factor that we've seen come up.
And why is it the 1 mile? Why do we consider a 1 mile radius when we're judging whether something's a food desert?
So that's actually been defined by the USDA. And what they looked at was they looked at low access communities and they looked at census tracts. And they saw that you would see an increase or a decrease in terms of ability for folks to access fresh fruits and vegetables, and particularly if more than 33% of the individuals living within that census tract, or at least 500 people, were able to or had to travel more than a mile to be able to get access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So they used that generic census calculation to come up with the statistic that gives us a definition for what's a food desert.
So, Christy, has this been a topic of conversation, the closing of the Kroger? Do you get a sense that this is going to make things more difficult?
Yes, ma'am. It will make everything difficult for our clients. They're actually having to travel 3 miles away to obtain nutritious food.
And they have to take a bus often to go grocery shopping. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So you guys serve, you're not the only, the food pantry in Augusta. Have you seen a rise in the number of people coming in?
We have seen a rise within the last month. Kroger has been closed for at least a month. So we've seen an increase about 25 people per week.
How do you expect to handle? Are you concerned that you won't have enough?
Definitely. We're concerned about we won't have enough to feed the people. However, we're trying to get grants and people to donate so we can supplement that.
Okay. So, I mean, it goes without saying, Garth, that not having access to fresh food is a health concern. I mean, I assume everybody knows that. But how much of a health concern is it? I mean, how dangerous is it to be 2 or 3 miles away from a vegetable department, for example.
It's a major health concern. In fact, the popping up of food deserts, or the increase in food deserts, is one of the things that we've linked to both a national and local rise in obesity. Because remember, it's not just that there's a lack of access to fresh and healthy foods. It's sometimes there's more access to unhealthy foods, and that helps to contribute to the obesity epidemic. And so many times you see both happening. You see people who have a lack of access to food in general, but then you also see this increased rate of folks consuming unhealthy food, and that has had a significant impact on our national adult and childhood obesity rates. So it's a very important factor, I think, that's been, as like I said, a major priority for folks in both the public sector and the federal government level, as well as the private sector.
So we have a tweet from Catherine Cummings who says, food deserts are a bigger problem in rural than urban areas. People easily 10-plus miles from fresh food, no public transportation. Garth, is she correct there that this can be a bigger problem in rural areas?
Yep, she's definitely correct. And by the definition, it's really just the distance one has to access practically to be able to access food. So it's a major problem in both urban and rural areas.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Garth Graham. You just heard his voice, president of the Aetna Foundation. And also with us is Christy Cunningham, executive director of the Downtown Cooperative Church Ministries, which operates a food pantry in Augusta. We're talking about recent grocery store closings in Augusta. Christy, do you live in the downtown area?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
So how far do you have to travel to get to a full-service grocery store?
5 miles.
5 miles?
Yes, ma'am.
How long does your quick trip to the grocery store take? How long do you have to set aside for that?
At least 30 minutes to an hour.
So has this put any pressure on your own lifestyle? If I'm out of something to make for dinner, I run to the grocery store real quick. That doesn't seem like that's an easy possibility for you.
It's not an easy possibility. But again, I have transportation, so it doesn't really put a heart bearing on me.
Because you don't have to take the bus, but many people in the downtown area don't have a car.
Absolutely.
So, Christy, how do you see this moving forward? What would you like to see happen? I mean, do you buy the line from the Kroger and Whole Foods? Do you believe them that they weren't able to make it profitable?
I don't believe that from Kroger, in as much as they've been in the area about 25 years, and they've been self-sustaining for those many years. And a lot of the clients in the area live within 2 miles of the old Kroger. They bought medicine there. They bought all the grocery there. So I don't see why they won't be able to sustain.
But
now, Whole Food was further out.
And also higher prices.
Right.
So what do you think, though, is driving the closing of the Kroger?
Honestly, I don't know. Because they were a retail pickup for me. And so we would pick up the produce and things of that nature to provide out. The stores were always full, so I don't understand.
Garth, there's a lot of misconceptions about poverty and eating habits, I think. There's a myth that people who are low income eat food that's unhealthy because that's their choice. And I wonder what the truth is about if you make fresh produce available in urban areas and low income areas, does it get eaten? Does it get purchased?
It does. In fact, we have supported a number of programs across the country, in Michigan and in other areas, where what we found is that when people have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, regardless of socioeconomic class or background, they utilize it at the same rate. And so from our standpoint, this issue of access is a major issue.
And it becomes, in some case, a domino effect. Garth, does it not? Because if you don't have fresh produce, it does make you less healthy. And often these are in communities where access to health care is also not high. And so you can start to have a perpetuating cycle of unhealthiness. Does this become a generational problem?
Oh, it does. It becomes a multi-generational problem. And what you see, as you just articulated, is that in many of these urban and rural areas, there is a higher disparity in terms of health outcomes, meaning that a lot of the folks living in these areas have a higher incidence of diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, and those are the folks that need the most access to not just fresh fruits and vegetables, but also areas where they can exercise and participate in physical activity. So it is a challenging cycle, and that's why I think there are a number of folks who are thinking through in terms of tackling this problem.
Is there, Christy, a sort of typical client for your food pantry? What's the person that comes and eat there? What are they like?
Well, actually, we don't feed them. We give them canned goods and fresh vegetables to take home to cook. The average client that comes there are normally low-income, African-American, and people that live below the poverty line.
Is it typical for someone to dip in and out of the food pantry? In other words, to at some point need the help, then rise above the poverty line, then dip back down?
Yes, ma'am, quite often.
So you'll see people leaving and returning sort of in waves?
Yes.
So, Christy, what do you want to see happen? I assume you would have preferred the Kroger not to close, but what can the Augusta area do at this point?
We need to market ourselves and find us another grocery store to put here where Kroger was, or something that's accessible by bus line for our clients.
Garth, is there a chance that it's simply not profitable for companies like Kroger to have grocery stores in these areas or in rural areas? And is there another solution?
Yeah, well, so there are a number of solutions. And in fact, we've seen these solutions being implemented across the country. So certainly, you know, the major supermarket chains is one source of fresh fruits and vegetables. But there are also things like local farmers markets and community gardens. And we've seen where when there's an increase in farmers markets in low-income communities, that provides a lifeline of access to care. There are things like, you know, farm-to-school programs, some of which we support, and other support that help to bring the benefits of what's grown fresh in a number of locations straight to many of these urban and rural areas where there are food deserts. And so that's in addition to things like supermarket access. And so, you know, there are a number of solutions because it is a multifaceted problem.
And it sounds like it's a problem that needs to somehow be removed from the question of profit or loss.
Well, you know, that's one part of it. But we've also seen where, particularly, again, some of the things that we've supported, where we've seen where even if you work with local farmers to create economic incentive or create a way for them even to be able to use some of the supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits or some of the food assistance benefits to be able to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, that you create an economic engine. And so you can create an economic engine around getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables. We just have to be thoughtful about it.
That is Garth Graham. He's a cardiologist and president of the Aetna Foundation. We also spoke with Christy Cunningham, the executive director of the Downtown Cooperative Church Ministries that operates a food pantry in Augusta. Christy and Garth, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Just ahead, what is it like to live near the world's busiest airport? Loud, for one thing. First, though, we look at the Georgia doctor who has overseen a lot of last moments in prison. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A doctor who kills people deliberately. That is the subject of a new documentary, The Sandman. It follows Dr. Carlo Musso, an Atlantan who's executed Georgia's death row inmates since 2003. The short film was based on interviews with Dr. Musso talking about why he does or did this job.
My role in execution is one of end of life, is one of compassion for an individual who is about ready to die. Instead of a carcinoma, that individual's dying of a court order.
With us now is Lauren Knapp, director of The Sandman. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Now, Dr. Musso actually doesn't do this anymore. Is that correct?
Correct. As far as I know, he stopped participating last spring.
How did you convince him? It's clear from the documentary that this troubles him, that this is something that's on his mind a lot, his role in these executions. How did you convince him to do all these interviews and be so open about it?
So I was, when I reached out to him, I was very interested in just hearing his perspective and hearing his point of view. I saw him as somebody who's in this predicament, trapped between sort of the medical guidelines and the medical ethics and this position where he feels that he can be an agent of good. In this position, and I was just really interested in hearing his perspective and how he kind of understood his role in that place.
Well, let's hear a little bit of his voice from the documentary. It sounds as though it was almost a business decision at the beginning. Here he is just talking about when he was first asked to do this.
You know, shortly after our company started growing, I got a phone call from the Department of Corrections about helping out with the execution process, which here in Georgia is lethal injection. Sometimes in life, you have to take the bad with the good. And it's part of being a leader. It's part of being a totality of a healthcare solution.
What did he say about weighing that? I mean, what for him did you find were the pros and cons?
Right. So I think that part of the interview was pretty telling. He started his business, which provides health care to correctional facilities throughout Georgia and three other states in around 2000. And then in 2004, the team that participated in executions, the medical team stepped down and the Department of Corrections needed to find a new person to fill the spot. And so they reached out to Dr. Musso. And that at that point, he was still growing his business within Georgia. And so, as he says, you know, he wanted to be a totalitarian of a healthcare solution for the Department of Corrections. And so he goes on to say that he went to witness an execution to kind of see what exactly it would entail. And I think both the idea that he needed to really own the totality of the total of providing healthcare within the system, and also him seeing his role as somebody who could help alleviate suffering potentially in an execution, those combined to have him make his decision to participate and to participate for as long as he did.
So let's make it clear from the beginning that Dr. Musso does not actually support capital punishment. Here he is again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an advocate for capital punishment. It's ultimately arbitrary and very expensive and not necessary.
And in fact, he ended up paying a price to a certain extent for his role in this when it was discovered that he was connected.
When local media leaked out that I was the physician that was participating in the execution process, I was contacted by advocacy groups to stop my participation. They oftentimes would protest in both my home and my office and send me emails and get on me with social media and even challenge my license.
So why did he continue to do it despite pressure?
I think for those same initial reasons that he first started, as he says, he imagined if it were him or one of his loved ones on death row, would he want a doctor with his knowledge and skill set there in case something did go wrong? And his answer is consistently yes. When in our very last interview, the last time that I saw him, he had made the decision to stop participating. And part of that decision was because he wanted to become a more vocal advocate for physician participation in executions. And since then, I know he has had one debate with the Georgia Health Correctional Physicians Group. I can't remember the name of it exactly off the top of my head, but he definitely was interested in becoming a more vocal advocate for his role.
And in fact, he brings up a kind of a good point about those who criticize him taking a role at all. Here he is.
I don't think people who believe that physicians shouldn't be involved in execution would say the same for a priest. Being at the bedside at the time of an individual's death, particularly if he wanted that.
How long ago did you last speak with Dr. Musso?
We last spoke the last time I was there shooting, which would have been February of last year, February 2016. And then we've had a little bit of communication through email, but pretty minimal since then. And I mean, I think that that last soundbite that you played is an interesting one, because it's an interesting comparison, but I think it's a false comparison, which I kind of respond to in the film, in the interview.
You do,
But the idea that a priest or a rabbi being at the bedside, that person is there to help. To directly help the person who's being executed, and usually at the request of that person. The person who's being executed does not have a choice as to whether or not they want the doctor there, and the doctor there is not, he's not their patient. He or she is not the doctor's patient. And so it's a very different relationship. And the presence of a priest or clergyman is also not kind of giving this the sense of sanitization to the execution in the same way that a doctor might, or that the use of medical tools and drugs might.
Although, you know, we heard earlier he compared participating in the execution as treating a patient dying of cancer, except in this case he said the individual is dying of a court order. To what extent did you feel that he had to distance himself from what he was doing, or did you get the sense that he was fully involved?
I think that it would be very difficult for anyone in that situation to be fully present in a way. I think you have to emotionally distance yourself when you're in those positions. I think from the interviews that we did and my understanding, he was doing a job. And it was he didn't have a relationship with the inmates, the condemned individuals. He was simply there working for the Department of Corrections and doing a job and trying to be as professional as he could.
Now, you have views on the death penalty and on executions. Did you find that you learned something, or did your mind change over the course of making this film?
Yeah, and actually that was part of when I initially reached out to Dr. Musso. That was one of the very first things I told him, was that I am personally opposed to capital punishment, but I wasn't interested in making, you know, a protest film or an advocacy film. I was interested in looking at the complications that exist with people involved in it. And I still remain against capital punishment personally, but again, this film was more about the way that medicine was being used, or is being used, in executions. And in that regard, I don't know if my opinions changed, but I certainly developed a much more nuanced understanding of the role that medicine plays. I had come to it with this feeling that if we're going to be executing individuals, it should be in the most humane way possible. I think a lot of people share that idea. And I just assumed that a lethal injection is the most humane way to kill somebody. And I'm not positive. I'm not sure I agree with that 100% anymore, given the state of secrecy and the idea that we don't know exactly where drugs are coming from anymore. Yeah. I think it's become a lot more complicated.
That's Lauren Knapp, director of the new film, The Sandman, that follows Carlo Musso, an Atlanta doctor that was responsible for executing inmates in the state of Georgia. We did invite Dr. Musso to join us for this conversation. He declined. The film plays tomorrow at the Atlanta Film Festival. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Georgia led the nation in death row executions last year. 9 men got lethal injections. That's more than any year since capital punishment was reinstated nationwide more than 40 years ago. Now the debate over the death penalty has a new voice. A group called Georgia Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty is part of a national movement. I spoke with Mark Hyden, the group's national advocacy coordinator. Now, you're not really new. When did the group form completely start from its beginnings?
Well, the national organization actually launched in 2013 at CPAC, which is the largest gathering of conservatives in the United States, and it was a wonderful experience. We were welcomed with open arms, and I had so many people ask me, Where have you been for so long? I'm pro-life. I support fiscal responsibility and limited government, and the death penalty is completely inconsistent with those elements.
So, okay, the Georgia group began when?
We just launched last week, but we have a great core of individuals that are supporting us, people like conservative state representative Brett Harrell, David Burge, the former 5th Congressional District GOP chairman, as well as think tank leaders and activists from across the state.
Okay, I want to play you this comment from Kent Scheidegger. He's the legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. They support capital punishment. He is here speaking on the public radio debate series Intelligence Squared U.S.
An executed killer never kills again. We cannot say that for certain with a killer sentenced to life without parole. Life without parole is not a zero-risk option. If we choose life in prison for killers, we do risk killing innocent people.
And I think it's fair to say that's something we are used to hearing from conservatives and from the Republican Party especially. How does the opposition to the death penalty fit into the conservative view?
Well, conservatives, by and large, we have a distrust of our government. We don't trust the government to deliver mail, let alone make life and death decisions over American citizens, and that's where the risk is. Nationally, over 155 people have been wrongly convicted and sentenced to die. Six have been in Georgia, and we don't know how many innocent people might have been executed wrongly. So if you want to talk about the risk to innocent life, it's right there.
Okay, so let me play you one more comment from Scheidegger. Again, he's the legal director for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, and at this point, he's admitted there are a few of these cases you mentioned where innocent people were sentenced to death.
But ask yourself, where would those people be if they had been sentenced to life without parole instead? In most cases, they would still be in prison, and they would never get out, because an inmate who is sentenced to death gets a government-paid lawyer for the second review of his case and the third review of his case. And that is where this evidence often comes out.
Your response to that?
Well, that's kind of misleading, first of all, because there's one level of appeals where they're not given an attorney. So they have to hope someone will do it pro bono or do it themselves. Clearly, that doesn't always turn out very well. So again, he's still walking into the fallacy that, you know, this is a error-prone government program that imperils innocent lives. And that's undeniable. And instead, he's saying we should have it because it helps release innocent people? This is not a very good argument.
I saw that some members of the group on the national basis are also making a fiscal argument against the death penalty. What is that argument?
Well, the death penalty costs far more than life without parole because of the mandated legal proceedings. It's even led to tax increases. It led to tax increases right here in Georgia even, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are interested in that. So if it costs more than life without parole, but doesn't protect society any better, I call that incredibly fiscally irresponsible. And conservatives, by and large, we can be a little parsimonious when it comes to taxpayer funds.
That is the case. But how does this argument go with people who have for generations been very much in support of the death penalty as part of a conservative platform?
Well, I've experienced a lot of success with this organization. I've spoke at tea parties here in Georgia, Republican clubs, and by and large, almost every single time, I'll have a lot of people raise their hand and say that they changed their mind on the spot because they used to be a diehard supporter of the death penalty until, you know, they looked at it critically and they realized there is this risk of killing an innocent person, which is not pro-life, and there's nothing limited about giving an error-prone government the power to kill you.
So how did the death penalty become part of the conservative identity?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think for a long time, many conservatives bought into this law and order view of the criminal justice system. And, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s, we saw that on both sides of the aisle. And we've also seen the terrible consequences of that. So we're looking back at our mistakes. And, you know, I used to support the death penalty, too. And I admit I was wrong in that position. But now we're reexamining it.
So what was the piece of evidence that convinced you?
Oh, gosh, I really wanted to support the death penalty. I'm not going to lie. but I admitted that there was this risk to killing an innocent person, that it costs so much more than the alternatives. And it gave an error-prone government this immense power over the people. But I said, you know, if it saves lives through deterrence, then I can consider this a worthwhile government program. And that's a utilitarian argument that doesn't belong in conservatism. But then I found all these studies that show that it does not deter murder. So I had nothing left to hold on to.
Okay, that is Mark Hyden. He is the National Advocacy Coordinator for Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. That group recently started a Georgia chapter. Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, what happens to neighborhood residents when a big airport moves in or expands? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We talked earlier about a food desert in downtown Augusta. It turns out because Kroger and Whole Foods shut down, that there's miles for some residents before they get to a full-service grocery. And there's a conversation going on social media about that. Pax Bobrow tweets, Augusta is the second largest city in Georgia. We can do better. And Kenneth Job writes on Facebook, I live in Roberta, Georgia. Since the Piggly Wiggly closed, Roberta has become a food desert. It is 15 miles, about 20 minutes by car to the nearest grocery store in Fort Valley. And one of our guests mentioned that the Kroger used to supply a lot of prescription medications, but Patrick Holt says while a pharmacy may seem busy, that doesn't make it profitable. We lose money on nearly every Medicaid prescription that we fill. Same with EBT. You can join this conversation. You can call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. The neighborhoods around Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson Airport don't look the way they did a few decades ago, even a few years ago for some. Unlike the airport itself, they haven't grown or improved for the most part. As the airport has become the busiest in the world, communities around it have shrunk or in some cases vanished. That's the focus of a new book called Flight Path. The author is Hannah Palmer. She grew up in Forest Park and now lives in East Point. Her book documents the transformations of Atlanta's South Side. And Hannah Palmer joins us now. Hi there.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like you saw a photograph of your parents and it got you thinking about this because the city they were posing in doesn't exist anymore.
That's right. My grandmother gave me a small news clipping from 1978, the year I was born. And it showed my parents, who were kind of hippies. They were in a Lamaze class. So they were in the Clinton News
Daily. In 1978, that was newsworthy.
Yes. It was very novel at the time. And the caption said Mountain View Couple. And I was just curious about that. First of all, it's always fun to see your parents so young. My parents are divorced, so I didn't have many pictures of them together. But the bigger question for me is, what's Mountain View? Is that a neighborhood? Was that where they lived? So I started doing some research and discovered very little had been written about Mountain View.
It was an actual city.
It was a city.
With a police force and a tax code.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was very small, but it did have a charter. It was a city in North Clayton County, right on the edge of the east side of the Atlanta airport.
When did it disappear?
1978, the year I was born. So these are the last days.
So you killed Mountain View.
It's my fault.
And what happened to it? Was it swallowed up by the airport?
You know, that's a huge question in the book. What happened to it? Because as I asked people what happened to Mountain View, I heard a lot of different myths, a lot of stories that it was shut down due to corruption. The charter was revoked because the mayor was corrupt and there was all this scandal about the police force. All this stuff is true. But now that we're 30 years later and we look back, what happened to Mountain View is it got swallowed by the airport. It was right in the flight path of those northernmost runways, so it was terribly noise impacted. The people that were living there in Mountain View told me stories about just constant disruption, flights so low that you could see people's faces in the windows of the planes. It was no place to live. At a certain point, as air traffic picked up, it really was uninhabitable.
But you grew up with a certain level of noise your whole childhood, did you not?
I did.
When did you realize that wasn't normal?
Well, for a lot of people, it is still very normal.
That's not the general experience, I should say, that way.
Exactly. Well, I went away to college in just to Decatur, not that far away, but that was far enough that when I would come home to visit or, you know, to see my family, friends, or go to church, the noise was noticeable. And then when I moved away after college to New York and would come back, it was kind of shocking because the airport added another runway, which the fifth runway really is a flight path directly over Forest Park. And it wasn't just the noise, but just the visual, too. It felt like we lived under a freeway.
How did you go about finding some of these communities? It must have been a difficult research task to track down the history of these communities that went away.
That's right. And I didn't have, I'm not a reporter or a historian. I didn't really have the tools to begin asking these questions. So I just started talking to people that I knew. My parents had been in Clayton County for a long time, so they would be like, you need to talk to this person. And I got a lot of oral histories, just people telling me what they remember. But ultimately, I spent a lot of time digging around in deed books and, just in records. I mean, that stuff was kind of boring. At times, I would find little pieces that of the puzzle that were exciting. But I tell people now, one of the most helpful groups that I talked to were firemen, because it turns out that firemen know everything. They're often on the job for decades. They see cities change, and they know the buildings and the landscape intimately because they're doing code enforcement, and they're out like annually checking on buildings, and they know who owns the property. They know what happened, how the use has changed over time. And they knew a lot more than anybody else I talked to about what happened to Mountain View and to the houses where I once lived.
This is sort of, I think it was described by Atlanta Magazine as part memoir, part urban history. And you sort of weave your own story into it. And in a way, I got the sense, at least, that your personality in some way was shaped by being that close to the airport. How is that? You look surprised. You don't think feel that way.
I'll have to ponder that.
I had this sense when I was reading it that there was ways in which the airport, pardon the pun, but kind of overshadowed your childhood. It became kind of a part of your own history.
I think that's true for me and probably for a whole generation of people who grew up alongside the airport. That it's something of a literary device, but I think it's true that I grew up with the airport. My lifetime, being born in 1978, was a time when the airport was undergoing massive expansion and becoming the airport that we use today. It didn't look anything like that before the 70s. So it's not a stretch to say that we grew up together and now we're grown up and kind of looking at each other, trying to make sense of each other. But I think everybody kind of ties their own personal life up in the places where they live and where they spend time. And I tried to be intentional about doing that in the book. I set out to write some essays about these places, and in the process of research and talking to different people, I actually learned a lot about urban planning and design in that process. It's not a vocabulary I had at all when I started writing, and now I'm a professional urban designer. So there has been a transformation in the process of research that has been really empowering and given me a lot of peace about that change over time.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Hannah Palmer. She is an author. Her new book is called Flight Path, and it documents the evolving relationship between the Hartsfield-Jackson Airport and the communities that surround it. So in the process of becoming an urban designer, you found some successes and some failures. Can you give me an example of a place that you think was a mistake, a way in which the airport's relationship with the community went wrong?
I can't think of a mistake. I look back at...
What about the fact that it's not open, it doesn't have an observation deck?
I would call that a missed opportunity. There's, again, I grew up with the Atlanta airport. I live in the vicinity. So this is what I think airports are like everywhere. And only as, a professional now who works on aviation projects around the world, I see that not all airports have this function with their community. Some are more open. Some do have observation decks or public spaces where people can come and enjoy the airport. It's not...
Because the closest Starbucks to you is at the airport.
Right. That's a statistic I like to share that really for up until that Glenwood Kroger opened, there was no Starbucks south of I-20. inside the perimeter. None, except the one in the airport. So
that you couldn't get to.
Right. So I'm not in a food desert, but I've been in a, you know, Frappuccino desert for a long time because the closest amenities to my house are actually behind a wall, a security wall. So I've started kind of questioning that security wall. I think the stories that I've heard from all these different people who grew up near the airport were that it used to be a public space. People would go watch airplanes. People would go, like, park along the runways and make out in their cars. people would walk the gates like it was a catwalk, just something to do on a Friday night instead of going to the mall. Kids I grew up with would go to the airport. So that changed after 9/11 for good reason. But I think it's worth considering, if we have this big hunk of public infrastructure, how can we make it more of a public amenity that the surrounding community can enjoy?
And tell me about a success. I mean, we hear a lot about the economic development at the airport, although it has also been true that the economic development that goes on at the airport doesn't necessarily bleed into the surrounding communities. People, because it's so all-inclusive, people don't often leave the airport and go to a neighborhood diner in the way they might have.
It's not easy to do.
Yeah.
A lot of the tourist money is trapped inside of the wall. Yeah, there's so many employment opportunities at the airport. It's like one of the state's largest employers. So why is there so much unemployment in the immediate airport area? There's a lot of work going on right now with the Aerotropolis Alliance and this comprehensive planning across all the Aerotropolis area to kind of connect workforce development inside the airport with the surrounding communities. It's still sort of, the money's trapped in there. I'm trying to think of an example. I think the Tri-Cities, where I live, are really charming, historic railroad towns where more and more airport employees want to live, where they have lived historically, and now they're willing.
Returning.
Yeah, right. There's a real renaissance in those areas. And it's people who work for Delta and Porsche and inside of the airport. They want to be able to live in the community where they work. So that's a return to the past, that people actually are like, we can live near the airport again.
So it's kind of common when you go to any city that the area right around the airport is considered to be not a savory neighborhood, right? I mean, that's fair. Mm-hmm. It's a place that generally parents tell their kids to avoid. Why is that? Is it just the noise that makes that area less vibrant, less desirable?
The best I can understand it and explain it, and I'm not like a sociologist, is that as the noise impacts from the aircraft, and there is pollution in the flight path, and then the traffic impact, it just drives down property values. And in many cases, certainly the case of my three homes, is that these areas were actually rezoned. They were once residential neighborhoods. They were rezoned as industrial and commercial sort of light manufacturing areas. So again, that also drives down property values. It's just not, it's not a place where you want to spend time. And this is only directly in the worst impacted areas of the flight path that's the case. There's still a lot of areas outside of the noisiest, polluted places that are quite livable and lovely, and I live in one of them now.
How far are you from the airport? How far a drive is it?
I'm probably only like 3 miles from the airport, maybe 2 miles from the airport, but the drive is 15 or 20 minutes, depending on, you know, it's complicated getting out of the airport. It's not an easy thing to get in and out of. So it's not like I can ride my bike. I always tell people, take MARTA.
Because that's even from 3 miles away.
Sometimes I'll just take them to the East Point MARTA station because it's easier.
Do you like being in that close of proximity to the airport? Does it feel comfortable at this point in your life?
That's a tough question. I like the South Side. It's where I'm from. It's where my community is. There's so much I could say about why I love the South Side. I find it charming, and I know everybody. It's my world. It's where I have roots. There happens to be the world's busiest airport in my neighborhood. Sometimes I use it, and it's really convenient. I actually don't fly that much. I fly maybe 3 or 4 times a year, and it's no problem to get to the airport. Because I live just north of the airport, the noise isn't really any worse at my house than it is in, say, Decatur. So the noise doesn't bother me.
Because you're not in the direct flight path.
Right. The parallels run, the runways are parallel east to west. If you live at Camp Creek just west of the airport or in Forest Park just east of the airport, it's very noisy.
What did you end up, when you think back to when you very, very first started at this whole quest for information, where have you ended up? What changed in your mind about an airport's impact on the South Side?
Well, I've tried to be honest and even-handed about, you know, the airport. Like, I think I actually started out feeling, kind of angry. Like, the airport was my enemy, and it was a villain that I wanted to expose because it destroyed my neighborhood. And at this point, I also have traveled enough and visited enough southern cities to realize that the airport is the only reason I can live in Atlanta. It's made the city that we all live in and love. It's made a middle class possible in Atlanta. It is, it's the reason why my parents are here and where I am here, and despite having lived in other cities. So there's a complicated bargaining going on between the airport made Atlanta great, and it also degraded the South Side. I'm interested in the future, though, and how we can try to strike a balance between this amenity, this thing we have on the South Side, and actually making the South Side livable again.
Did you actually create plans and suggestions that you will deliver to the managers at Hartsfield-Jackson?
I have some ideas. I do. Just in case they're listening. I think that, you know, what I've been talking about creating some sort of public interface between the airport and the surrounding communities would be a gesture of openness. That could be some sort of park, or I talk about, like, I have two little boys and they love going to watch airplanes. And just last weekend, you know, it's beautiful Saturday morning, I took them to a little parking lot on the edge of a runway on the north side of the airport, which is great for watching planes. And it's just me and these two cute little boys watching airplanes, and security comes and pulls up, you know, right in front of us, you know. So there's really no public place. If you're hanging out watching airplanes, you look suspicious in Atlanta. Like, just make a little place where the community can enjoy the spectacle of the world's busiest airport.
That is author Hannah Palmer. We've been talking about her new book, Flight Path, which looks at the changing landscape in the neighborhoods around Atlanta's airport. That book comes out on April 4th, and Hannah will host a launch party on April the 13th. That'll be at the Highland Inn and Ballroom Lounge, 7 p.m. Hannah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's our show for today, but we always welcome your comments, especially if you live in the Flight Path or on the South Side of Atlanta or in another city where you have the noise of airplanes above your head. We'd love to hear about your experience. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. One person, Vince Aragon, says, I grew up in Forest Park around the same town as Hannah. I feel like Forest Park was a forgotten community when planning for the growth. Let us know what you think. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.